Tomorrow, by Joseph Conrad. What was known of Captain Agbert in the little seaport of Colebrook was not exactly in his favor. He did not belong to the place. He had come to settle there under circumstances not at all mysterious. He used to be very communicative about them at the time, but extremely morbid and unreasonable. He was possessed of some little money evidently, because he bought a plot of ground, and had a pair of ugly yellow brick cottages run up very cheaply. He occupied one of them himself, and let the other to Josiah Carville, blind Carville, the retired boat builder, a man of evil repute as a domestic tyrant. These cottages had one wall in common, shared in a line of iron railing dividing their front gardens. A wooden fence separated their back gardens. Miss Bessie Carville was allowed, as it were of right, to throw over it the tea cloths, blue rags, or an apron that wanted drying. "It rots the wood, Bessie, my girl," the captain would remark mildly, from his side of the fence, each time he saw her exercising that privilege. She was a tall girl, the fence was low, and she could spread her elbows on the top. Her hands would be red with the bit of washing as he had done, but her forearms were white and shapely, and she would look at her father's landlord in silence, in an informed silence which had an air of knowledge, expectation and desire. "It rots the wood," repeated Captain Agbert. "It is the only unthrifty, careless habit I know in you. Why don't you have a clothesline out in your backyard?" Miss Carville would say nothing to this. She only shook her head negatively. The tiny backyard on her side had a few stone beordered little beds of black earth, in which the simple flowers she found time to cultivate appeared somehow extravagantly overgrown, as if belonging to an exotic clime, and Captain Agbert's upright, hale person, clad in number one sailcloth from head to foot, would be emerging knee-deep out of rank grass and the tall weeks on his side of the fence. He appeared, with the choler and uncouth stiffness of the extraordinary material in which he chose to clothe himself for the time being, would be his mumbled remark to any observation on the subject, like a man roughened out of granite, standing in a wilderness not big enough for a decent billiard room. A heavy figure of a man of stone, with a red handsome face, a blue wandering eye, and a great white beard flowing to his waist, and never trimmed as far as Colebrook knew. 7 years before, he had seriously answered, "Next month, I think," to the chaffing attempt to secure his custom made by that distinguished local wit, the Colebrook barber, who happened to be sitting insolently in the tap room of the New Inn near the harbor, where the captain had entered to buy an ounce of tobacco. After paying for his purchase with 3 halfpence extracted from the corner of a handkerchief which he carried in the cuff of his sleeve, Captain Agbert went out. As soon as the door was shut, the barber laughed. "The old one and the young one will be strolling arm in arm to get shaved in my place presently. The tailor shall be set to work, and the barber, and the candlestick maker. High old times are coming for Colebrook, they are coming, to be sure. It used to be next week, apostrophe now it has come to next month, and so on soon it will be next spring, for all I know." Noticing a stranger listening to him with a vacant grin, he explained, stretching out his leg cynically, that this queer old Agbert, a retired coasting skipper, was waiting for the return of a son of his. The boy had been driven away from home, he shouldn't wonder, had run away to sea, and had never been heard of since. Put to rest in Davy Jones' locker this many a day, as likely as not. That old man came flying to Colebrook 3 years ago all in black broadcloth, had lost his wife lately then, getting out of a third-class smoker, as if the devil had been at his heels, and the only thing that brought him down was a letter, a hoax probably. Some joker had written to him about a seafaring man with some such name who was supposed to be hanging about some girl or other, either in Colebrook or in the neighborhood. A nigh, ain't it? The old chap had been advertising in the London papers for Harry Agbert, and offering rewards for any sort of likely information. And the barber would go on to describe with sardonic gusto how that stranger in mourning had been seen exploring the country, in carts, on foot, taking everybody into his confidence, visiting all inns and alehouses for miles around, stopping people on the road with his questions, looking into the very ditches almost, first in the greatest excitement, then with a plodding sort of perseverance, growing slower and slower, and he could not even tell you plainly how his son looked. The sailor was supposed to be one of two that had left a timber ship, and to have been seen dangling after some girl. But the old man described a boy of 14 or so, clever-looking, high-spirited boy. And when people only smiled at this, he would rub his forehead in a confused sort of way, before he slunk off, looking offended. He found nobody, of course. Not a trace of anybody, never heard of anything worth belief, at any rate. But he had not been able somehow to tear himself away from Colebrook. It was the shock of this disappointment, perhaps, coming soon after the loss of his wife, that had driven him crazy on that point, the barber suggested, with an air of great psychological insight. After a time, the old man abandoned the active search. His son had evidently gone away, but he settled himself to wait. His son had been once at least in Colebrook in preference to his native place. There must have been some reason for it, he seemed to think, some very powerful inducement that would bring him back to Colebrook again. Ha, ha, ha. Why, of course, Colebrook. Where else? That's the only place in the United Kingdom for your long-lost sons. So he sold up his old home in Colchester, and down he comes here. Well, it's a craze, like any other. Wouldn't catch me going crazy over any of my youngsters clearing out. I've got 8 of them at home. The barber was showing off his strength of mind in the midst of a laughter that shook the tap room. Strange, though, that sort of thing, he would confess, with the frankness of a superior intelligence, seemed to be catching. His establishment, for instance, was near the harbor, and whenever a sailorman came in for a haircut or a shave, if it was a strange face he couldn't help thinking directly, suppose he's the son of old Hagbard. He laughed at himself for it. It was a strong craze. He could remember the time when the whole town was full of it. But he had his hopes of the old chap yet. He would cure him by a course of judicious chaffing. He was watching the progress of the treatment. Next week, next month, next year. When the old skipper had put off the date of that return till next year, he would be well on his way to not saying any more about it. In other matters he was quite rational, so this too was bound to come. Such was the barber's firm opinion. Nobody had ever contradicted him. His own hair had gone gray since that time, and Captain Hagbert's beard had turned quite white, and had acquired a majestic flow over the number one canvas suit, which he had made for himself secretly with tarred twine, and had assumed suddenly, coming out in it one fine morning, whereas the evening before he had been seen going home in his morning of broadcloth. It caused a sensation in the high street shopkeepers coming to their doors. People in the houses snatching up their hats to run out a stir at which he seemed strangely surprised at first, and then scared. But his only answer to the wondering questions was that startled and evasive, for the present. That sensation had been forgotten, long ago, and Captain Hagbert himself, if not forgotten, had come to be disregarded the penalty of daylightness as the sun itself is disregarded, unless it makes its power felt heavily. Captain Hagbert's movements showed no infirmity. He walked stiffly in his suit of canvas, a quaint and remarkable figure, only his eyes wandered more furtively perhaps than of yore. His manner abroad had lost its excitable watchfulness. It had become puzzled and diffident, as though he had suspected that there was somewhere about him something slightly compromising, some embarrassing oddity, and yet had remained unable to discover what on earth this something wrong could be. He was unwilling now to talk with the townsfolk. He had earned for himself the reputation of an awful skinflint, of a miser in the matter of living. He mumbled regretfully in the shops, bought inferior scraps of meat after long hesitations, and discouraged all allusions to his costume. It was as the barber had foretold. For all one could tell, he had recovered already from the disease of hope, and only Miss Bessie Carville knew that he said nothing about his son's return, because with him, it was no longer next week, next month, or even next year. It was tomorrow. In their intimacy of backyard and front garden, he talked with her paternally, reasonably, and dogmatically, with a touch of arbitrariness. They met on the ground of unreserved confidence, which was authenticated by an affectionate wink now and then. Miss Carville had come to look forward rather to these winks. At first they had discomposed her. The poor fellow was mad. Afterwards, as he had learned to laugh at them. There was no harm in him. Now she was aware of an unacknowledged, pleasurable, incredulous emotion, expressed by a faint blush. He winked not in the least vulgarly. His thin red face with a well-modeled curved nose had a sort of distinction the more, so that when he talked to her, he looked with a steadier and more intelligent glance. A handsome, pale, upright, circumpable man, with a white beard. You did not think of his age. His son, he affirmed, had resembled him amazingly from his earliest babyhood. Harry would be 31 next July, he declared. Proper age to get married with a nice sensible girl that could appreciate a good home. He was a very high-spirited boy. High-spirited husbands were the easiest to manage. These mean, soft chaps, that you would think butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, were the ones to make a woman thoroughly miserable. And there was nothing like a home, a fireside, a good roof. No turning out of your warm bed in all sorts of weather. H, my dear? Captain Egbert had been one of those sailors that pursue their calling within sight of land. One of the many children of a bankrupt farmer, he had been apprenticed hurriedly to a coasting skipper, and had remained on the coast all his sea life. It must have been a hard one at first. He had never taken to it. His affection turned to the land, with its innumerable houses, with its quiet lives gathered round its firesides. Many sailors feel and profess a rational dislike for the sea, but it was a profound and emotional animosity, as if the love of the stabler element had been bred into him through many generations. People did not know what they let their boys in for when they let them go to sea, he expounded to Bessie. As soon make convicts of them at once. He did not believe you ever got used to it. The weariness of such a life got worse as you got older. What sort of trade was it in which more than half your time you did not put your foot inside your house? Directly you got out to sea you had no means of knowing what went on at home. One might have thought him weary of distant voyages, and the longest he had ever made had lasted a fortnight, of which the most part had been spent at anchor, sheltering from the weather. As soon as his wife had inherited a house and enough to live on from a bachelor uncle who had made some money in the coal business, he threw up his command of an East Coast collier with a feeling as though he had escaped from the galleys. After all these years he might have counted on the fingers of his two hands all the days he had been out of sight of England. He had never known what it was to be out of soundings. Have never been further than 80 fathoms from the land, was one of his boasts. Bessie Carville heard all these things. In front of their cottage grew an undersized ash, and on summer afternoons she would bring out a chair on the grass plot and sit down with her sewing. Captain Egbert, in his canvas suit, leaned on a spade. He dug every day in his front plot. He turned it over and over several times every year, but was not going to plant anything just at present. To Bessie Carville he would state more explicitly, not till our Harry comes home tomorrow. And as he had heard this formula of hope so often, that it only awakened the vaguest pity in her heart for that hopeful old man. Everything was put off in that way, and everything was being prepared likewise for tomorrow. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.